Ladies and gentlemen, welcome wrestling fans worldwide to Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains for the Ron Fuller Tennessee Studcast.
6 feet 9 inches tall, 265 pounds.
This historic podcast from one of the most respected and successful wrestlers and promoters will follow the footsteps of the largest and oldest wrestling family on the planet.
The Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller.
Through 93 years and four generations.
The Stud has arrived.
Old school or new fan, this unique broadcast will educate and captivate as Ron details decades of professional wrestling's growth with truly unforgettable stories.
I want those people out there at home to hear the Stud.
Sit back and enjoy the ride with the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud. You will learn that name. You will remember it.
And now,
the Stud is here.
Please welcome your Studcast host of television and radio fame, Tony Basilio.
Man, I can't believe another week has flown by, and it is time for us to do this one more time. It is episode 27 on your Studcast. And before we do anything else, I just want to thank the great Brian Last for helping to spread the word on what we're doing here. It is a great pleasure to be a part of the Arcadian Vanguard family of podcasts, and there's so many great new offerings there. And Stud Brian has us literally everywhere. You know, I didn't thank him last week, but wanted to go ahead and get that out there because, you know, look, this New Year season is a time of Thanksgiving. It's a time of reflection. And I didn't want to let another moment go by without thanking the great Brian Last. Stud, here we are, man. We're back.
Yes, very glad to be here. And since you brought up Brian Last, we're honored and pleased to be a part of his Arcadian Vanguard podcast network. And gosh, you've got, he's got some hosses. You talk about a stable full of stars. You know, he's got the Jim Cornettes there. He has his own 605. He has some great podcast going, and we are one of them. We are the only independent one, so far as I know. I think we do our own thing here, Tony, and Brian helps us to get our name out there and to get us on the iTunes and Podcast Addict and wherever you get your podcast from. We're there because of Brian. Thank you very much, Brian. Only other place you can reach us is at tnstud.com. That's my website, so you can get everything there. Beyond that distribution, Brian is the man that makes it happen for the Studcast around the globe, and we really thank him for it. Great way to start our 2018 is doing just that. I want to throw in something else since you brought it up. Jim Cornette does these segments with me called Storytime with the Stud. And he does those suckers about every other experience. The Jim Cornette Experience program, he takes 20, 30 minutes sometimes, and he lets me tell stories. He actually joins me in the storytelling. I enjoy that too. And Jim is such a talent. He's such a phenomenal talent. He's just crazy on this podcast. His ability and what he does is just crazy in itself. So this is a nice time to thank Jim as well, and Brian too.
Yeah, Corny's absolutely crazy. I want to give a shout out to Breaking Kayfabe with Baldrin and Barry. Those guys are doing a great job over at the Arcadian Vanguard family. So a special shout out to Baldrin and Barry. They've got a huge listener in yours truly. Stud, when last we left, it was the mid-60s. In fact, 1966 to be specific. You had teased that your father was about to have, as part of this 93-year, four-generation lineage, your father was about to have yet another supercard, another crown jewel type of event where he was going to throw it all on the table and come what may. I mean, your dad lived on the absolute edge when it came to promoting events. There was nothing conservative about your father when it came to promoting events. And I know you want to do some of that today. So, Stud, saddle that thing up. She's looking good. She looks like she's ready for a good long ride. Take it, my man.
Oh, yeah. This is a thrill for me. And I copy a lot of this. In fact, I copy a lot of what my dad did, not just in the ring, but out of the ring as a promoter as well. And just to take us back a few weeks when we were talking about the Zany Night in Georgia event in Ponce de Leon Baseball Stadium, and Dad put together one of the greatest cards ever put together, and did what he did so well, he ended up drawing the largest crowd ever in the history of Georgia. He had already done it in the state of Alabama. He had done it in the state of Tennessee. He had done it in Arizona. So now he's a year out, or a little further than a year out, in the summer of 66. He decides that he wants to have another mega event. Pretty phenomenal. When you do one of these mega type of promotions, you may never want to do it again because it's scary. Like you have said, it's scary to say, well, what if I bomb? And what if I do badly with this one? And if it doesn't do well, is it going to make my business weaker rather than stronger? All those questions come to mind when you think, I'm going to spend a lot of time, I'm going to detract from my normal weekly program that I have and my normal weekly crowds that I create in order to build toward this mega event that's going to draw five times the audience and the crowd that I normally draw, maybe even as much as eight times in some cases of what you normally draw. So it's scary. It's a little bit scary. And he never hesitated. You're correct about that. He never hesitated about putting these things together. And what he does for this one is totally different than what he did for the Ponce de Leon Park 38,000 crowd that showed up that night in 65, the summer of 65. This time, he bases it around something that he has some knowledge about, something that he has done before that drew him big crowd, a huge crowd. And the last one that he drew with it was in Memphis, Tennessee, in Rosswood Park, the largest crowd ever drawn in the state of Tennessee. It was with a Cadillac tournament. Dad was really, like my granddad, he was a fan of Cadillacs. And my old granddad used to drive that Cadillac down the road 120 miles an hour with me in it and just got over when somebody came, when he had to, only when he had to. He had the big siren on it. He had the badges when he pulled out when he got stopped. He had the light, you know, that he put up in his dashboard. He was a maniac running the highways in his Cadillac, and Dad became a Cadillac man. And I'm going to be honest with you, I kind of became a Cadillac man too. And once I started wrestling and making some money, I couldn't hardly wait to get my first Cadillac. It was like the back in the days in the 60s, it was like the car, and it was the most expensive, and it was the car, basically. So if you're going to give away an automobile, you're going to probably, and you really want to do it right, it's going to be a Cadillac. And that's exactly what he did, is he pieced together this Cadillac tournament. He had had it in Memphis before. He had known that it would draw a big crowd. But he didn't do this event over a short period of time. The way Dad did Cadillac event, and I copied this, I had several of them myself. It wasn't always Cadillacs. I finally evolved from doing Cadillacs to doing Nissan 280Zs and to giving away sports cars and different types of vehicles that weren't Cadillacs. But Dad's was the Cadillac. He was focused on the Cadillac. So he would put these Cadillac tournaments together, and he would intertwine them into his normal events, which was really brilliant of him. The Cadillac tournament, this Cadillac tournament lasts 4 months. It takes 4 months of eliminating people that are in the tournament to get down to the finals. So he starts out booking these preliminary, you've got a huge, huge number of people. I'll just give you some of the names that I remember that are in this Cadillac tournament. And these are small part of the Cadillac tournament. But when they start announcing this event, you build this event in several different ways. First of all, you want to show your car. You're going to show the car. You buy the car for 4 months ahead of time, and you show the automobile that's going to be given away. And then you start to create a name. I used to do it by putting together a big sign that I brought to the arena every week. It had all of the contestants that's entered the tournament. And fans could come. I'd put it in the back of the arena. I put a spotlight on it. It was a 4x8 piece of plywood painted nicely with the names of all the contestants in the Cadillac tournament. And as a person was eliminated, they would go back there and color his name out, darken his name off the board, and at the end of the night, if you had a Cadillac elimination match, if you lost, they took your name off the board, and winners obviously stayed there. So it was a great little concept of you had to let people know who's in the tournament. And when you start to tell people about the tournament and you start to cover the names and who's going to be in this tournament, who you're going to get to see, the stars that's coming for the Cadillac, you know, then you're building this for 4 months. So when you build an event for 4 months, if you can't draw more people than what you normally draw, you've really done a poor job. And Dad always did a great job of promoting the Cadillac tournament. This is only the second one that I remember he ever did. He did the one in Memphis, and now he's going to do one in Atlanta. He's the big venue man. He's got to go to the big venue. Now, he's been to the ballpark. Ballpark's not there anymore. That Ponce de Leon Park there in 65 gets torn down the year after the event because the Atlanta Braves come to Atlanta and they build their stadium just outside of on 75 there as you enter Atlanta on the south side of town. They build that stadium there. I don't know particularly why he did not pick that stadium, but I think he wanted to go bigger. He wanted to say, you know, I don't want to draw 40. I want to draw 60,000 people, maybe. I don't know what his head was, or what his number was, or what his focus was, but he announces, and I remember being a young boy and watching the program, obviously, and they announced when this 1 week that they were going to have a Cadillac tournament. They showed the photo of the car. They actually brought the car into the studio so that you could see the car. And then they said the site for this big finals will be Atlanta International Raceway. He goes NASCAR. I mean, he's going to a 100,000-plus stadium anticipating that, you know, he may need all that. That in itself speaks pretty highly, doesn't it, Tony, about his grandeur and his thoughts?
Telling you, I... One thing that I love about doing this is just hearing what a character your father was, and he had no fear. You know, from the very moment you introduce him into your story about how he's chasing rival promoters out of places and telling fans down in Memphis, don't bother coming back. We see your face. This is the last time you'll be here at ringside. We don't need your kind, to his first ever super show. And then right on down to the Ponce de Leon thing where that's jam-packed, some of the other pictures you've painted about the one of the winners of one of those events trying to fight their way out of there and get through traffic. I mean, if there was mayhem, chances are your father was somewhere in the middle of it, concocting it, coming up with it, and here we are. Now, you got to tell me, he probably bit off more than he could chew in this deal here, because you told me that Ponce de Leon deal was the largest outdoor stadium, so obviously, he didn't need as big a venue as he set up here.
Yeah, and I'm going to leave that toward the end of this, okay? I'm not going to start with that, you know, because he has something unfortunate that happens that causes that. Because I think had this not happened, what's going to happen in the end here, he would have done that 50, maybe 60,000 people. So he sets up the Cadillac tournament and he announces it and they bring the car in the studio. Dad had a real good, his marketing was tremendous. He really had a concept of what clicks in people's brains and what really makes them go, wow, this is big, you know. Then he had a way of presenting things, and that's the way his presentation was, is bring that car in there, let them see it. He brought the car in the auditorium in Atlanta every night, in which for 4 months. So you saw the car every week, and every night they would have about two elimination matches per night. And I guess he somewhere sat down and figured out, if I've got 40 guys, and I'm going to eliminate two every night. I'm going to need 20 weeks, whatever it was. And that's my 4 months down the road is going to be the finals. And he had it all planned out, and he promoted it as a part of his normal event, which was pretty ingenious. Enhanced his card without having to have a monster attraction. It's just the fact that this is an elimination match, and they would do a great job of announcing it. I remember this as a kid. And at this point now, I'm a senior in high school. I'm not really a kid anymore. I'm just about to be an adult. And they would make a big deal. Ladies and gentlemen, this is a Cadillac elimination match. If you lose tonight, your chances of winning that beautiful car back there is gone. That type of presentation. And then they would start their match. Now, he backed himself up by just going out and planning ahead. And it takes a long time to put one of these together. He wanted to know, how many big name guys can I get? When I put my board out there that shows the 40 people that are in it, I'm going to have maybe 10 from my regular crew, and I'm going to have a significant amount of big names out there. So I'm just going to go over some of them that I can remember that were in this tournament. And there's a lot of them here. I'm going to apologize in advance that I do not remember. But these are some of the names that I do remember that came in specifically for those Cadillac elimination matches, lost, and were gone. You didn't see them again for a long, long time. Sometimes, maybe never. Some of them made their only appearance that I ever knew in Georgia. Were involved in this Cadillac tournament. So there was Dick the Bruiser, big name. We're talking 60s, mid to late 60s. He's recognized pretty much worldwide, big in the wrestling magazine. That's where wrestling was promoted back in those days. It was in magazines. There was no internet. There was no television, national television. You had to promote your own guys on your own television. If you wanted to bring a star in, you had to look to Bill Apter's Wrestling Illustrated or some of those guys' old magazines and thumb through there, and that was your stars. Everybody recognized those people. When you got picked up in there, that's where you were a star.
Before you go start rattling off those names, how did you interface with the magazines in those days? You promoted, your dad was a promoter. They don't have to write about every territory. There's a ton of territories out there. So what do you have to do to get in those magazines, Stud?
Back in the day, you didn't go to them. They came to you. They knew who were stars. They had guys, I think that they probably had guys that they really wanted to push, guys that they liked. And they said, we're going to run more pictures and we're going to run more stories about this guy than some of the other guys. I got stories when I was young in the wrestling magazines. And a lot of that was because I was a part of the Welch Dynasty, the name. They had done stories on Roy way back in the day. They had done stories on Dad because he was a fairly big star. And then when I came along and Rob came along, we got put in those magazines simply because we had the name. There was some recognition there. It was kind of like being in a talent contest. You had to have the talent, but you also had to have the backing of whoever was producing these magazines, and it could really push you and make your name quickly. Or if you never got in them and you weren't seen much, you just remained anonymous and just were recognized in whatever territory that you were in. I remember being in 1973, might have been 74, opening a magazine, one of the wrestling magazines, and there I was, the top 10 in the world. I was like, wow, gee, who knows who's the top 10 in the world? I mean, that's somebody's pick of like, I'm going to pick 10 names out of the wrestlers in the country, and I'm going to say that these are the top 10 in the world. You know, I don't know that I was the top 10 in the world. I don't know who made that chart or who picked those names. But it was a big boost for me. People that picked that magazine up, if they didn't know who I was, they're going, well, who is this guy? How the heck is he in the top 10? So if they put you there, then they're going to do stories built around you because they got to legitimize the fact that they put you in the top 10. So it's a strange little deal the way wrestling magazines work. It was very influential to the wrestlers and to the business itself.
Really interesting stuff. So you're getting ready to outline that super card, which obviously would have been covered big time back then, featuring the Cadillacs. So give us some of the participants, Stud, in that deal.
Okay, I started out with Dick the Bruiser. The next one was Sheik. Sheik was a big star, came out of Detroit up in there, you know, a lot of magazine coverage. Fritz Von Erich, a lot of magazine coverage. Freddie Blassie, huge magazine coverage. Sam Steamboat, great wrestler. Didn't get as much magazine publicity as the others I've just named, but probably a much better worker. A tremendous worker. And then along comes the guy that's supposed to be his son, which really wasn't his son. It's Ricky Steamboat. And Ricky was a fabulous worker. Could have been his dad's son. I mean, he fit the mold of Sam Steamboat. Lester was in it. Lester Welch, who had been there, had won half the World Tag Championship the year before. Herb was one of his ending matches in his career. Former World Junior Heavyweight Champion, all that background that he had. Len Rossi, huge star from out of the Tennessee area. Great athlete, tremendous body, tagging around. Really, really a great addition to other guys that were there. Georgie Animal Steel. I mean, crazy pick there, but later on I will wrestle the Animal in Australia. And that, to me, I watched his match in the tournament, and I think he won a couple of times and then he lost as the tournament dwindled on down. He was a character. He gave the tournament a different concept of wrestling. Fans got to see somebody that they walk away going, my gosh, man, what is that all about? So, you know, Vern Gagne comes to South, don't make trips down there very much. Vern's just got his thing going as that big name because he's the Olympian. He wrestled and represented the country in the Olympics, and he's a great amateur background, and now he's a professional. He has a big name and a big reputation. Johnny Weaver, star out of the Mid-Atlantic area. Big guy in the Crockett's territory. So Dad picks him up because he's really familiar with him. Johnny Valentine, there's another big name. Young guy at this point, really a star, going to be huge. And I'm going to end up working with him. There's a lot of guys on this list that I'll go back in a minute that I end up actually wrestling before it's all over. But I watch them. I get my first chance to see some of them right here in this tournament. Malenko, the great Malenko, comes out of Florida, down there in Florida, been all over the country and many, many places, proved himself to be a great, great talent. A young Bobby Shane. Bobby Shane in his first early years, he called himself later the King Bobby Shane. Tremendous wrestler and young and could really go, could really, really move around. Bruno Sammartino. Big Northeast guy. Magazines. These people, a lot of these guys are magazine stars, and that makes them Atlanta stars. Even though they've never been there, when he announces on his regular card that we're going to have two Cadillac elimination matches, and one of those is Bruno against somebody, and the other one is, let's say, Georgie Animal Steel against somebody, your card is made. Your house is already there. It's certainly going to build your house. But at the same time, it built the quality and the excitement and all the things that makes people get into a four-month-long event. And so finally, it comes down, the finals come, and it's taken 4 months. It's going to be on a Sunday afternoon, okay? Like a la football game, you know, basically. A big major event deal. You don't do it on the Friday night when you normally wrestle. This is not a Friday night event. This is a mega event. It's going to be Sunday afternoon, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, at Atlanta International Raceway. Big, big venue. Huge. Now you encounter all the problems that come with. Now, he's got the idea, but now he has to say, how am I going to make it happen? One thing he did not consider is the fact that the track is banked, okay? Even in the straightaways. Now, you set the ring up in the straightaway, and It's just massive. I mean, there's a massive amount of seats there. So he wants to put ringside, but he can't put ringside because there's enough bank there that you have to put something that lifts up one side of the ring so that the ring is level and flat. So they encounter that problem and they figure out how to do that, but they ditch all the concept of ringside because ringsiders would be sitting at an angle about to slide out of their chairs. So that has a bearing on what goes on. The finals turn out to be Dick the Bruiser against Sputnik Monroe. Now, Sputnik is a name, been around there for a long darn time. Sputnik has paid his dues. Sputnik makes it to the finals against a world-class, big-name guy. It's kind of like I'm going to harken back to the event, the Zany Night in Georgia event in the ballpark in which Sputnik works with Antonio Rocca. Now Sputnik is going to wrestle in the finals for the Cadillac, and he's going to wrestle against Dick the Bruiser. So Sputnik, he's kind of wild. He's the one that smacked Antonio Rocca the year before, and Rocca leaves the ring and won't come back and finish the match. So you don't know what Sputnik's going to do in a case like this. The event's set. It's publicized. It comes on the Sunday afternoon. They don't know really what to expect. I think he's probably expecting 40,000 plus. He's probably disappointed if it's going to go less than 40,000. I was a young boy. I was a senior in high school, and I go to it. And we drive there 3 hours before match time, and it's about to rain. Now, talk about killing someone's mindset. He's waited 4 months. He's built 4 months. He's put 4 months into this, and the only thing that can destroy his day is rain. And we start driving from home to the racetrack, and the skies are gray, and they're saying it's going to rain. It's 75-80% chance of rain. I'm feeling for my dad. I'm like, wow, this is just horrible, you know. So we're going to try it. They're going to open the gates. They're going to sell some tickets. They're going to try to put the event on. So they tell people at the main gates where they're entering that if it rains, this is a rain check. You can come back. But when you get rain at a big event like this, it's going to take the impact away from it. I don't care what happens after that. So they probably have, I'm going to guess, and it's hard for me to guess at something like this, but they probably had, I'm going to say, 20,000 people, and they're sitting in the stands when the rain comes. And they sit there in the rain for a while, and then they start to leave. And at that point, it's horrible for my dad. I just have to identify the whole deal. Finally, they announced that, sorry, but we're going to have to set this for next Sunday. So they bring it back the next Sunday. It's better weather. It's still a cloudy day. Is there still a chance of rain? It's a summertime event. It happens all the time in the South. They stood a chance of raining again. They end up ultimately drawing somewhere between 25 and 30,000. Now, I don't know the exact number. It's a big venue. It's a huge straightaway on a racetrack that you know, how big stands are for NASCAR events, and that's where they held NASCAR races. And it was hard to figure out how big it was. But the part I remember about that event that's kind of crazy is they parked the Cadillac on the track, not too far from where the ring was. And I remember that Monroe was busted. He was bleeding, kind of like happened with Billy Wicks in Memphis many years earlier. It was busted and bleeding, and Monroe wins the car. He beats Dick the Bruiser in the middle of the ring, and he goes and gets into the Cadillac, and he's going to get blood all over his new car. He doesn't care. He drives that car around to the far side of the track. He had to have it up to 120 miles an hour. He just wheels around to the far side of the racetrack. You can't hardly see him. Now he's way over there by himself. He gets out of his Cadillac. He climbs up on the hood of his car, brand new car, and he does his old deal from Memphis. He gives him the profile shot. He turns sideways, and he drags that finger down the tip of his nose and off his chin, way across the track over there in his brand new Cadillac. I was like, wow, what a moment. I wish I'd had a shot or the camera shot of that. It would have been just about as good as when they carried the Cadillac off the field in Memphis.
And he's up on the high. I could just picture that he's up on the high bank turns. So all those things your dad didn't anticipate about being in that stadium. He's done a ton of these outdoor shows. Weather's always been good to him. Now all of a sudden the bill comes due. And some of the guys earlier on that you had mentioned that were in this thing that you eventually crossed paths with in the ring, man, just thinking about that, I'm thinking about what it must have been like for a young stud like yourself to be there at that event, just to be in the presence of all that terrific young talent.
Oh, gosh, man. Some of those guys were older and they were mature at that time, but I'm glad you brought that up. I'm going to show real quickly. I wrestled later on. I was going to wrestle Dick the Bruiser. I was going to wrestle the Sheik. I was going to wrestle Freddie Blassie. I was going to wrestle Eddie Graham. I didn't mention Eddie Graham's on that card. I was going to wrestle Eddie Graham. I was going to wrestle George the Animal Steel in Australia. I was going to wrestle the Malenko many times in Florida, Bobby Shane, Bruno Sammartino in St. Louis. I mean, I'm going to wrestle a lot of these guys that come through this tournament. No idea of that at that point. And if you had told me at that point that someday, Ron, you will be in the ring with these guys, I would have said, no way will that ever happen. So it was a phenomenal event, kind of disastrous ending the way it happened to it. But like you said, he had the guts to say, I'm going to beat the biggest crowd that's ever been done. I'm going to get a bigger one next year. To be honest with you, there are no more of these mega events. I think this took the heart out of him to try to do another big one after this rain.
Yeah, and who can blame him? But back to what we were talking about, which is the event itself and the way it ends and everything that went in, the status of the Cadillac, just the whole day, the whole deal. Let me ask you, what's the biggest bath you've ever taken in honor of that event and what your dad walked into that day at the racetrack? What was the, looking back on it, something that you did as a promoter or maybe even something you were a part of as a worker that just did not get off the ground?
I remember we worked outside in Knoxville before we went to the Coliseum. We wished to work in an indoor building in the winter, and in the summer we worked in a park there. It was an amphitheater. It probably held 5,000, maybe 6,000 people. It was a beautiful amphitheater. It was a Homer Hester Lee.
Homer Hamilton. Whatever. Homer Hamilton right over there at Chilhowie Park in Knoxville.
There you go, the old Chilhowie Park, the amphitheater there. And I remember having one of these big events. We had worked a long time. It would might have been with Don Carson in the back when he had the black glove. And I had just turned babyface. And we were going to put the glove on the pole, some kind of match like that. We were expecting to sell out that amphitheater, and we got the rain. It just takes the heart out of you. You know, you come back the next week, and you go ahead and do it, but it loses its luster somehow in that week that's lost, and the event being postponed, and we're going to do it next week. Those type of events, that's one of the reasons I went to the Coliseum, is because that happened to me, and I said, this is ridiculous. I can't afford to have a lost events like this in the summertime. I said, I got to go to the Coliseum, and that's when we first started, when wrestling first started going to Knoxville Coliseum.
You know, you never even stop and think about that. You see all these outdoor events that take place. I mean, you're really playing with fire from a promoter standpoint, because you're going to fly all these guys in, you're going to pay for that. You're going to book the building, you're paying for that. You're paying for catering, you're paying for all the tickets, all the printing, all the stuff. I mean, you're all in. And if Mother Nature does not cooperate on that day, hey, see, you wouldn't want to be you. That seems like playing with fire there, Ron. Really does.
Yeah, it is playing with fire, and he knew it. I mean, he knew it was an outside event, but so did he know it in Rushwood Park in that event. So did he know it in Ladd Stadium in that event of 40,000 people, Rushwood Park at 28,000 people. He did experience a little bit of that in Arizona. He had a rain out with the first time he tried to do that monster event in Arizona, and it came back strong enough that he still broke all-time Arizona attendance records. But yeah, you're always taking a chance. And like you said, he went one too many. He had three good ones. Now he comes back and he has the disaster on the fourth one. It's hard to break those monster numbers. When you're drawing 30, 40,000 people, it's hard to get something that's going to draw more than that. But hats off to him. He certainly gave it the big attempt.
No question. Now it's time for us, and speaking of attempts, we're getting ready to step away. Before we do, though, I know you want to say something, as here we are. We're in, oh my gosh, it's hard to believe. We're in episode 27 here. It is hard for me to believe that we've been doing this for over half a year, Stud, but we've got a special show that's out there right now, a special opportunity to talk about the first ever Super Stud Cast.
Yes, and it's not going to rain at this one. And that's the wonderful part about it. The rain will not kill this one. And it's actually going to happen, Tony. It's going to happen in four more days. If you're listening to this Stud Cast on Wednesday prior to the 14th of January, in just four more days, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, at 12:01 a.m. Sunday morning, you're going to be able to go and pick up the first ever Super Stud Cast on Andre the Giant. And I'm just psyched about it. You and I know we've already recorded it. I feel like it is the best work I've ever done so far as podcasting. I want to invite everybody to listen to it, to hear it. It's only going to cost $2.99. You're going to get that 2 hours of Andre's stories. You're going to leave that program when it's over with a different feel for Andre the Giant. You're going to have a personal experience with Andre. I hope that's what you're going to end up with. And you're also going to get another hour program 2 weeks later on the 28th of January. Same deal, 12:01. You're going to get the rest of the Andre story, called The Rest of Andre Story. And you'll be able to go there, the same site you went to when you're going to pay for this week. You're going to get it at either tnstud.com on the website, and you hit Super Stud Cast, you're going to get it. And if you go to Patreon, that's Patreon, if you want to do it through Patreon, you go there, you go to that Super Stud Cast, and once you've taken care of that, you will get the broadcast immediately. That broadcast, and I want to remind fans, that Studcast will be there forever. It's going to be available to you whenever you want to buy it. But I know that thousands of fans are going to want to buy it right off the bat and hear it. And so will the backup. So will the other program, the rest of the Andre story. That will be available to in perpetuity. You can go there anytime you want to. If you're not available to get it on Sunday, take it on Monday, take it on Wednesday, whatever time you want. But you'll have the opportunity. It will be there. You can go and buy it at any time. We're very hopeful here that you will support us here. This is something that we spend a great deal of time on, and it's such a ridiculously small amount that we're at. $2.99. It's less than a dollar an hour. You're going to get 3 hours of exclusive content. You're not going to get this anywhere on YouTube or any place else on the internet. This is where you can find it. We just encourage you to go and have a listen. I believe that we're going to get great response from it. And I think they're going to enjoy the next one, actually, because the next one is one of my funniest stuff that I do, that I've ever done and I've ever witnessed in my life, is the Bahama thing and third world countries, wrestling in those third world countries. It's pretty amazing. That will be a great one, too. But please, fans, if you really love Andre, I think you're going to have a different perspective of Andre the Giant after you listen to this Super Studcast.
There's no question. I just know from being a small part of that deal, and I stayed out of the way, Stud really brought it. And I can't wait to hear the reaction of people because, Ron, you really laid it out there on the Super Stud Cast featuring the life and times of Andre the Giant. And again, so what the Stud was saying is, let's say you're hearing this in your own time. Let's say you're hearing this somewhere deep into 2018 and you just found us. You can still go back and you can still purchase, and you can still listen to both the Andre the Giant Super Stud Cast and the Compendium Hour Special that you'll get with it as well on the back end of the Andre the Giant Super Stud Cast. In the meantime, we're going to take a brief time out. We're going to come back, and the Stud will pick the story back up. We also have some great questions that we're going to get to from this wonderful audience. In the meantime, David Summers has some business he wants to tell you about, and we will continue on the other side here on the Studcast right after this.
The entire world is only a few days away from experiencing the first Super Studcast. One of the most famous and beloved people on the planet, Andre the Giant and Ron Fuller, will make history at 12:01 a.m. Eastern, Sunday, January 14th. This fantastic two-hour Super Studcast will be followed 2 weeks later on Sunday, January 28th, by a bonus one-hour question and answer podcast. The rest of the Andre story, a first time ever double main event in podcast history. For only $2.99, you'll receive both podcasts. That's 3 hours of exclusive content and entertainment in January from America's best storyteller, the Tennessee Stud. The Super Studcast will never be available on the internet or any other platform. There are only two ways to hear these podcasts. Anytime you want to listen on January 14th or later, go to tnstud.com and click on Super Studcast and follow the direction, or go to patreon.com/studcast and click on Super Studcast. It's that simple. Go back to the same location you ordered from on January 28th or later and click on the rest of the Andre story. You'll pay only $2.99 for both. Once again, either tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast will saddle you up for an unforgettable ride. And now we resume Studcast number 27 with Tony Basilio and the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller.
And we welcome you back on your Studcast. Tony Basilio along with the Tennessee Stud, the great Ron Fuller. Stud, let's get to the questions here. We've got some great ones today.
Super. I always love the questions. Let's get them rolling. I'm saddled up and ready for it.
Tom Hale out of Louisville, Kentucky. Jim Coronet country. You'd mentioned Corny before. Home of Castle Coronet. And our first question today wants to know, Stud, did you ever get to wrestle the great Ernie Ladd?
Oh, yeah. I'm so lucky. I have gotten to wrestle so many, many big names. And quick answer is, yes, I have wrestled Ernie Ladd. But I got to talk a little bit about Ernie Ladd. Ernie Ladd, I think we talked about Don Leo Jonathan last week, seems like. A big guy. Ernie Ladd is just as big as Don Leo Jonathan. Ernie Ladd is my height, 6'9", and around 300 pounds, and a bona fide, tremendous athlete. I'm not sure about this, Tony. You may know this. Is Ernie Ladd in the Football Hall of Fame?
I don't think he's in the Football Hall of Fame, although he was a highly decorated professional football player. I'll look that up, but I don't believe he's in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. But he was a very good in the old AFL defensive lineman.
So whether he was or not, Ernie Ladd had a presence about him. He did great interviews. Just fabulous interviews. So in order to be a great wrestler, you've got to have the skills in the ring. But it's just as important that you've got the skills when you sit down behind that microphone, because that draws you just about as much money as your ability in the ring. And Ernie Ladd had that thing about him. Ernie Ladd had that college background. Played football in college, went to the pros, made a huge name for himself, broke into wrestling, worked a lot around the country, but I don't think Ernie wrestled for as many people as he could have with his name and with his reputation. He became a real big star for Bill Watts out of the Oklahoma and Louisiana territory. Became a name big time, and he stayed with Bill for lots of years, quite a few years. I got to see him some because my territory butted up next to Bill Watts. Bill had his program. He ran Mississippi, from Mississippi on into New Orleans and back up into Oklahoma, and I ran things from basically Alabama over to Florida and up into almost Ohio. So we ran different areas, but we had a great deal of respect for one another. And I wrestled Bill Watts many, many times and wrestled partners with Bill and wrestled against Bill. So we had a personal relationship. And I remember that I got to see because I lived in Pensacola. I got little small things of, I got to see Ernie some. And I was very impressed. And so I asked Bill, I called Bill and said, Bill, I'd like to have Ernie. Can you send me Ernie Ladd? He said, Ron, I'll send you Ernie if you'll make me a deal. I'll send Ernie and you work with him in Mobile if you'll come and wrestle him in Biloxi, Mississippi, big Coliseum in Biloxi. So I said, absolutely, we'll do it. So we traded. Ernie comes to me. I go and wrestle Ernie in Mississippi. In Mobile, I do remember the event. There's two buildings in Mobile. One building holds 15,000 or so. The second building was called Expo Hall. That night, I wanted to get the big building because Ernie was going to draw me a big crowd. Ernie was very popular in the Deep South. But I couldn't get it. There was an event in there that night. So I had them reconfigure the Expo Hall from being a 3,500 seat capacity to almost 5,000. That's all we could get in there. And we actually packed it further than that. The fire marshal finally cut us off. But Ernie came across from Oklahoma, and Ernie and I had a phenomenal match. I mean, a tremendous match. It was just, it was great to wrestle a guy that's my size. And then we went back, and Ernie enjoyed it like I did. After the match, he says, geez, man, you're great. I said, well, you too, man. You know, for a big guy, he had a lot of ability, and he had a lot of movement. He wasn't slow, and he could do some things. So I go back and work with him, but yes, the answer is, yes, I worked with Ernie, and I really, really enjoyed it immensely and had a pretty good bond with Ernie. I wish I had been working in a territory with him, but I would have liked to have made trips with Ernie and got to know him a whole lot better.
Yeah, you were talking about Ernie's football career, just digging into that. Guy comes out of Grambling State, and at that point in time, the AFL, just as a matter of sports history, the AFL was much friendlier to the black athlete back then, and the AFL really made its bones over the NFL in getting involved with and carrying many, many, many of these guys that came out of traditionally black colleges. And Grambling State is where Ernie Ladd went to school. He played with the San Diego Chargers for five seasons, four of which ended up in AFL title games. Played for the Houston Oilers for 2 years, the Kansas City Chiefs in 67 and 68. He retired at the end of that 68 season and jumped into wrestling full time because, as he said, the money was better. And so Ernie Ladd was a guy who was great, great at two things that he did in his life. He was a great football player and he was a great wrestler. And outside of Wahoo McDaniel, stud, I'm not sure who else you could say that about, that they were great wrestlers and great football players. I'm sure I'm missing a couple guys, but I'm talking about modern era guys that were great at both things.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, Mongo McMichael tried it. You know, he can't carry those guys' jockstrap. No way.
Oh, no, no. I mean, you know, it's hard to cross over between those two sports. And Ernie did a great job of it. He was a phenomenal athlete. I think, and you mentioned that Kansas City thing. If I'm not wrong, I believe that Kansas City played in the Super Bowl, mm-hmm. the second Super Bowl. Mm-hmm. And Ernie was on that team. If that was about 67, 68, mm-hmm. the early, mid-60s. So that would mean Ernie played in a Super Bowl game on a team that made it. The AFL champions. They were the champions of his league. And I can't remember who played that year in that game, who won that bowl. But I mean, I know that it wasn't until Joe Namath won the next year that the AFL ever won that. The first two games were won by the Packers, I'm pretty sure.
That's right. Yeah, the Packers beat them.
The Packers probably played Kansas City in that second one.
Yeah.
So that's amazing stuff. Amazing stuff. Ernie Ladd, great question. Wherever that question came from, that's an absolutely great question.
Yeah, so Tom Hale, you knocked it out of the park up in Louisville, Kentucky. Let's get our second question in. This is from a gentleman who hails from Fairfield, Ohio, Jeff Guller. Jeff wants to know, when you were involved in hockey, did you ever consider any of those hockey enforcers, did you ever nudge them toward a career in professional wrestling? Those in mind, Cincinnati's Kevin Kerr, Scott Shaughnessy, Rob Krause, or Nashville's Brock the Rock Kelly, or Jeff Shotgun Salz.
That takes me back a ways. It's great to get a hockey question every once in a while. I can't believe some people, we're so wrestling-oriented here that they've done their homework. This guy's a fan. He's a hockey fan, and obviously, I think he said he's somewhere in Ohio, so he's probably in the Cincinnati area. At one time, I owned two hockey teams, and one was in Nashville, one was in Cincinnati. Every hockey team had enforcers. There's a couple of stories here. I'm going to go with one real quick one. It's when I went to get into hockey. There was an East Coast Hockey League. I sat down with four owners. The league was in its infancy. Now it's the biggest minor league hockey operation in the world. Huge, huge league. And I sat down with the owners, and I say, "Do you have any concerns about me?" And they all looked at me and said, one of them said, "You're not going to hire a bunch of goons, are you, for your team?" So I said, "What are you talking about?" And he goes, "Well, we don't want to have all kinds of fights. We want to have some decent hockey." So I had to jump that hurdle before I could get into the league to begin with. So every team has these enforcers, they're called, and they're tough kids that are willing to fight. And their basic job is to go out there and skate as well as you can. Most of them can't skate very well, but they fight pretty good. So they go out and they keep an eye on the good players that are getting a tough time, and they'll back them up. They'll take on anybody that's really giving a tough time to their little small player that's scoring the goal. And some of those names really bring me back a ways. Out of all those guys that I just heard you mention, there was none that I would have ever thought. You can't transfer ability on the ice to ability in a wrestling ring. First of all, just because you're tough and you fight good doesn't mean you have any skills at all in wrestling, and you probably are not going to make it unless you do both of them at the same time. Ernie's a great example, turned from football to wrestling, but there's a better link between football and wrestling than there is between hockey and wrestling. Hockey is a all-leg sport that done on skates. It's unique in what happens in hockey as compared to football translating to wrestling. You've had a lot of great football players. Bill Watts was an Oklahoma star, University of Oklahoma. Yep. Turns into a great wrestler. Got a lot of football players become good wrestlers. That's not so the case with hockey players. But I did have a guy in Nashville, and I got to talk about this guy for just a little bit because it's really unusual, and I really liked him. He was a wrestling fan. He was one of the few players that ever got sent to the East Coast level by a NHL team. Lou Lamoriello, the gentleman that made the New Jersey Devils, the team and the organization that it is, sent me a player named Billy Hewitt. And I had an announcer that you're very familiar with named Craig Jenkins.
The Nut.
The Nut. Okay, Craig Jenkins is the announcer, and Craig Jenkins makes stars. That's how Brock the Rock Kelly became Brock the Rock, and Shotgun Salzburn became, that was all Craig. And so Craig, we get this kid named Billy Hewitt, and he comes in, and he's just a wrestling nut. And he's like, "Oh, my God, you're a wrestler. Oh, geez, this is unbelievable." This kid had big body. He was strong. And he was rugged. He liked to fight. So the first night we introduced him, I never know what Jinx is going to say when he's introducing somebody. He has a nickname for half of them. And we darken that building. Boy, we play bad to the bone. And he brings them onto the ice. And he brings out Hewitt at the end of the deal. And he says, "Bad boy, Billy Hewitt." So right away, the crowd expects this kid to be bad. And I think it turned the kid on. The kid heard himself being introduced as Bad Boy Billy Hewitt, and he decides, "I'm going to be a bad boy." He became such a bad boy that Lamoriello found out that he was down there fighting, right? Lamoriello didn't send that boy there to learn how to fight. You know, he sent him down there to learn how to play hockey. So, you know, it was like, Lou Lamoriello calls me up, and he goes, "Ron," he goes, "What's the deal with bad boy?" I had to explain to Lou, "Well, you know, that's Craig Jenkins, my announcer, you know, kind of gave him that name." And he goes, "But Ron," he goes, "I'm watching things, And his penalty minutes are pretty damn substantial. He goes, I think you're trying to turn him into a bad boy. It was really funny. Bad boy Billy Heard. But if I was going to answer the question, I would say if I was going to do it with somebody, that would have been the kid. He really had the knack, and he was a tough, really tough kid.
The wrestling-hockey crossover, there's not many. Chris Jericho's father, Ted Irvin, was a great player. I remember him in the 70s, particularly with the New York Rangers back in the day. He was a real tough guy and a really great player and played an era where you had to be really tough. In fact, hockey of the 60s and 70s reminds me a lot of the elements of it, of the wrestling of that period. Very heart and soul, very hard-scrabbled guys. You went to a hockey match in those days, pretty much any barn in North America, and you got your money's worth from the way the game was played. They didn't have helmets on. It was a very unique and interesting sport then compared to what it's become now. It's still a great game, but it's just completely different. It's kind of like wrestling itself. Stud, on the way out, and what an awesome effort by you today in episode 27. Boy, we've got a huge one dropping on Sunday. Drop it on them one more time, Stud, on the way out here.
Okay, let me pick a winner here real quick, though. I think I'm going to take the hockey question. I believe I'm going to make that guy the winner. I think his name was Jeff.
Jeff Guller. Jeff Guller of Fairfield, Ohio. Congratulations.
Yeah. I think we're going to call him the winner today. One more time, you know, we're doing this because this is the last time before this coming Sunday. If you're listening on a Wednesday and this program has just dropped, you're 4 days away from the first ever Super Studcast. And it's going to be a phenomenal event so far as the covering of Andre the Giant. I think you're going to get the feel for Andre the Giant that you've never gotten before. I encourage you to listen, spend that $2.99, and you'll get that program plus the follow-up program 2 weeks later for free. It will cost you no more money for that, and it will be a question and answer that anybody that has a question, I need to cover this, and I'm glad you brought this up. If you have a question, this program is going to air on Sunday. If you want to ask a question that's going to be included in this 1 hour question and answer, the rest of the Andre story, you need to do it between Sunday and Monday night. You have 48 hours from the time this broadcast drops in which to go to Facebook to Ron Fuller, Tennessee Stud, that site, or you can go to Ron Fuller Welch, either of those two, and I will put on there a post that says, list your questions here if you've heard the broadcast. And that's where the questions are going to come from. That's the way you're going to be able to be heard if you get awesome. Your question asked on there. And I encourage you, I want to be able to finish Andre properly. And we've done a great job in the first 2 hours, but I know that what we do in this broadcast is going to create as many questions as it does answers for people. And I want to be able to finish the rest of the Andre story. And so if you want to ask those questions, that's where you go. Facebook, Ron Fuller, Tennessee Stud, that's Tennessee spelled out, or Ron Fuller Welch. And you find that post and place your questions there. And we will be giving you that program on January the 28th, Sunday, January the 28th. Buy one of these, you're going to get two. You buy that Studcast, you're going to get this second one for free. And I encourage fans, if you really love Andre and you want to hear something that's unique and totally different, this is going to be your Studcast. Thank you very much again for listening. Everybody out there worldwide, I sure just consider it an honor and a privilege to sit in this seat, the old East Tennessee area here in the Tennessee Mountains, and be able to do this show for you every week. And we're going to be right back here next Wednesday. We're going to keep dropping these regular Studcasts. These new programs that we're introducing are not going to take anything away from what we're already doing. So please support us. If you like, you want to hear something good about Andre, give it a listen, and I'll be looking forward to the comments. I think they're going to be phenomenal.
Stud, awesome job by you. Thanks again for another week. Thanks for letting me be here. I want to thank everybody from behind the scenes who's helped make this a possibility, including the great Craig Jenkins, the aforementioned Craig Jenkins, who put us together several months back. It's been a great run. In the meantime, remember, that giant Super Stud Cast, and I do mean Giant Super Stud Cast, 2 hours plus long, is dropping on Sunday. Get over to tnstud.com, get more information on that, get signed up. Don't be left out, don't be left off. And until we meet again, for all those behind the scenes, for the great Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud, this is Tony Basilio wishing you a great Studcast week.
Thanks for joining us today for this historic Studcast. The true story continues next week. So fool Nelson your friends and point them in our direction for another ride with the Tennessee Stud. This is David Summers saying so long from the Great Smoky Mountains. This Studcast is distributed by Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. For inquiries about vocal work, send an email to davidsummersproductions@gmail.com.